Nuclear heroes. Think a single person can't make a difference in dealing with the power of the nuclear industry and its toadies? Think again. When one woman in a small western Pennsylvania town, she began investigating the impact of that radioactive facility on her community and soon discovered.
I went around door to door, and in one community, there was a street that had 16 homes. There were 8 homes in a row that all the women had breast cancer.
And she discovered so much more, which led to an $80 million federal lawsuit settlement, plus more than $74 million in compensation from a federal entitlement program for nuclear workers. Now, this ferocious and loving warrior, Patty Amino, has passed away, but her legacy lives on as a model for fighting back against that awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevy. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we mourn the loss of activist Patty Amino and commemorate her life with an interview from 2016. Patty's one-woman battle to gain accountability and compensation to her community for radiation exposure caused by Nuclear Materials and Equipment Corporation, or NUMEC, the nuclear facility right across the street from where Patty grew up. Hers is one of the most successful fightbacks in the history of the movement of those who oppose nuclear. It's a powerful story of how one woman made an enormous difference and still stands and will continue to stand as a model to us all. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, the return of Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story with Linda Pence Gunter, and more honest nuclear information than Speaker of the House Mike Johnson is willing to hear to get him off his butt to put the Radiation Exposure and Compensation Act to a vote on the House floor. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, May 21st, 2024, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Here in the U.S., the clock is ticking for the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, or RECA, which provides health screenings and compensation for people sickened by radiation from U.S. nuclear weapons production and tests. After 22 years, RECA is set to expire on June 7. This would mean not only an end to life-saving health screenings and compensation, but also to the hopes of thousands of downwinders and uranium industry workers who have been unfairly excluded from the program for decades. A bipartisan majority passed the bill in the Senate, and it is believed there are enough bipartisan votes to pass it in the House, but House Speaker Mike Johnson has refused to bring it to a vote. Despite growing outcry from Senator Josh Hawley, Representative Cori Bush, cities and counties that would be included for the first time in RECA, and downwinders from around the country who have descended on Congress pushing for the vote to take place. We will have a link up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 674, which gives you the direct connection to Speaker of the House Mike Johnson's office.
Nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, numbnuts of the week.
Last week on the popular U.S. television network program Meet the Press, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham appeared to suggest that Israel should use nuclear weapons to end its war in Gaza, saying that the U.S. decision to, quote, end the war by bombing Hiroshima and Nagasaki with nuclear weapons was, quote, the right decision. So wrong, so ignorant, on so many levels, and that's why, Lindsey Graham, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Numbnuts of the Week.
NuScale, which claims to be a developer of small modular nuclear reactors, or SMRs, has no credible orders and has not landed a single deal since the termination of a contract with Utah Associated Municipal Power Systems, or UAMPS, and this was caused by cost overruns. Without any serious customers, NuScale's marketing now leans heavily on one claim, having the first and only small modular nuclear reactor design certified by the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. However, journalists who have echoed this story have not questioned its meaning, and that is that the model that got approval is not the same one that NuScale is flogging now. The model that NuScale wants to commercialize has zero approvals because of the change in design. In other words, NuScale has deceived investors about the certification of its reactor. Journalists, take note, this should be the talking point you start with. Instead of getting us off nuclear power dependence, a new Russian uranium import ban will further condemn Native American communities to new uranium mines. Here's Linda Pence Gunter, fresh back from her sabbatical, with this week's Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story.
When Russia first invaded Ukraine on February 24, 2022, no one knew how long the fighting would continue and what the outcome might be. Kyiv was expected to fall immediately. It didn't. How to squeeze Russia economically was the immediate concern. The answer came in the form of a ban on imports of Russian oil, gas, and coal. US President Biden enacted it quickly, less than 2 weeks into the invasion. Uranium was not on the list. Many of us in the anti-nuclear movement agitated for a Russian uranium ban as well. Between Russia at 12%, Kazakhstan at 25%, and Uzbekistan at 11%, almost half of America's uranium supply comes from Russia, or countries where it has a controlling interest. We knew that a Russian uranium ban could help push the US away from nuclear power and force a shift in the energy agenda, with a promotion of renewable energy and energy efficiency development as the priority. Instead, last week, Biden signed a bill that is effectively a poison pill for Native American communities. It's called the Prohibiting Russian Uranium Imports Act. It should really be called the Gold Mine for Uranium Corporations Act. And it doesn't even really ban Russian uranium. There is a vague waiver that says the US can continue to import Russian or Russian-controlled uranium until at least 2028 if, quote, no alternative viable source of low-enriched uranium is available to sustain the continued operation of a nuclear reactor or a United States nuclear energy company. And it's not even clear that Kazakhstan is included in the ban. Kazakhstan clearly doesn't think so. This bill represents a significant opportunity for Kazakhstan, the world's largest producer of uranium, which could potentially step into the breach and provide the mineral necessary to meet the US's nuclear energy needs, they said. What the bill really does, of course, is silence and victimize the same people already living with the deadly health and environmental legacy of the 4,000-plus abandoned uranium mines across the U.S. and who are vigorously fighting the opening of new uranium mines. One such, the Pinyon Plain Mine, has already started operating, putting at risk the water supply for the Havasupai tribe who live deep in the Grand Canyon. Uranium will continue to poison the Grand Canyon, including the aquifers that feed into the Colorado River, said Carletta Tolusi, a Havasupai leader. Contaminants from the uranium mine are likely to make their way to the deep aquifers that feed Havasu Springs. The mine closure is the only way to avoid this risk, she said. On the Navajo Reservation, another company is threatening to open a mine close to Church Rock, the site of the deadly 1979 dam burst that sent 90 million gallons of liquid radioactive waste and 1,100 tons of solid uranium mill wastes into the Puerco River. The resulting contamination has never been cleaned up. Navajo leader Larry King called Biden's decision last week to sign the Russian ban bill as terrible news. He knows firsthand how this will go. They've never returned an aquifer to pre-mining stages, he told me. The companies got what they want out of Navajo and moved on. Of course, no one in the mainstream media talked to anyone from Native America when the Russia bill was finally signed. All the fanfare was about the great profit-making opportunities and energy independence, another nonsense. So the winners will be Russia, whose uranium will continue to flow here, since domestic uranium production cannot hope to ramp up overnight, and the multinational corporations, who will further plunder our lands. Those silenced and condemned are the same voices that have been ignored throughout history. It's our job to help raise them. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter from Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's Hot Story.
In Japan, at the wrecked remains of the Fukushima nuclear power plant, Tokyo Electric Power Company, or TEPCO, has begun a second round of discharges of radioactive tritium-contaminated water into the Pacific Ocean. This began on May 17, and the second round is set to last until June 4, when approximately 7,800 tons of the radioactive water will be released. Despite protests from citizens, fisher people, and concerned ocean experts around the world, TEPCO plans to release about 54,600 tons of this radioactive tritium-contaminated water in seven rounds during the fiscal year that started last month. At the United Nations, the UN Security Council has rejected a Russian-backed resolution on banning weapons in space. This resolution rivaled one backed by the United States and Japan that failed at the Security Council last month. The problem? They focused on different kinds of weapons, with the U.S. and Japan specifying weapons of mass destruction, meaning nuclear, and the Russian draft discussing all kinds of weapons. The partisan voting on both of these resolutions split evenly 7-7 between backers of the United States and of Russia, with Switzerland abstaining. Of course, Switzerland would abstain. Paul Meyer, Canada's former ambassador for disarmament, said, "We have this negative, squabbling attitude among leading space powers that seem more interested in scoring points off their adversaries rather than engaging in constructive dialogue." There is already in place the 1967 Outer Space Treaty, which requires countries to keep their weapons on Earth. And the danger comes from more than just launching a nuclear weapon or any kind of a weapon from space to Earth. By exploding a nuclear weapon in space, the electromagnetic pulse generated could fry the electrical systems and electrical generating grid of any countries that are underneath it. I refer you to the book by Professor Stephen Starr, Nuclear High Altitude Electromagnetic Pulse, A Mortal Threat to the U.S. Power Grid and U.S. Nuclear Power Plants. We featured Professor Starr on our Nuclear Hot Seat number 626 from June 21st, 2023, where he goes into great detail as to what a single nuclear explosion in space and the resulting electromagnetic pulse could do to life to us here on planet Earth. North Korea has voiced strong objection to the recent U.S. subcritical nuclear test and has vowed measures to bolster their own nuclear deterrence. The U.S. nuclear test, conducted underground and referred to colloquially as tickling the dragon's tail, took place in Nevada last week and is the third of its kind under President Joe Biden. The U.S. said it was designed to collect essential data, put that in quotes, about its nuclear warheads. But a spokesperson at North Korea's foreign ministry said that the country cannot but reconsider the measures necessary for improving its overall nuclear deterrence posture. The country enshrined its nuclear power status in its constitution last September. And the International Atomic Energy Agency's Incident and Trafficking Database reported on this past Monday that 31 countries reported a total of 168 incidents in which nuclear or other radioactive material was lost, stolen, improperly disposed of, or otherwise neglected last year. And this is, quote, in line with historical averages. The IAEA noted that six of these incidents were likely related to trafficking or malicious use, meaning uranium and/or plutonium, which can be used in making atomic bombs, were involved. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment. But first, I was recently at a social gathering for professional journalists and did my best to network some of the information I've gained here at Nuclear Hot Seat with these reporters, columnists, and educators. Sad to say, most of those I spoke with had at most a cursory familiarity with nuclear issues, and only one was able to engage in meaningful conversation with me. Of course, he was retired. These are the people we must trust to spot nuclear untruths, call out the industry, and convey legitimate concerns to the public. So the lack of understanding I encountered goes a long way to explaining how the nuclear industry gets away with their focus-grouped, misdirecting talking points. And that's why you need Nuclear Hot Seat. Our different perspective is the one that roots out the truth about nuclear with verifiable stories and interviews with credentialed experts who share footnoted, peer-reviewed information that is diametrically opposed to the nuclear PR talking points. In just 3 weeks, Nuclear Hot Seat will mark the completion of 13 years of weekly programs. That's more than 670 hour-long episodes and counting. They deal with the entire nuclear spectrum, from weapons and reactors back to uranium mining, transport, refining, manufacturing fuel rods for reactors and plutonium pits for bombs, the unsolvable problems of storing radioactive nuclear waste, accidents, health impacts, failure of the industry to clean up its existing mess, political shenanigans that give billions to nukes while denying support to citizens who have been harmed by radiation and starving wind, solar, and other genuine renewables of necessary funds. Yes, it's a lot, but you couldn't tell any of this was happening if all you follow is mainstream media. This is where we come in. So help Nuclear Hot Seat celebrate our 13th birthday and launch into the 14th year with a tax-deductible donation of any size, either one time only or a recurring monthly gift. As I said, we are a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donations are tax-deductible. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button. Or if you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Please don't wait. Donate now. And whatever you can do to help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here's this week's featured interview. Patricia, better known as Patty Amino, is something of a legend for her work to force accountability and community compensation for radioactive contamination by the nuclear fuel processing facility across the street from where she grew up in Apollo, Pennsylvania. Patty passed away on May 10, 2024, after a lifetime fighting for justice and against multiple cancers. But she leaves behind a legacy of effective activism, the very model of the power of a single individual. And she also leaves behind this interview, which was recorded for Nuclear Hot Seat number 239 on January 20th, 2016. Patty Amino, welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat.
Glad to be here, Libby.
Where did you grow up and what was the area like?
Apollo, Pennsylvania. It was basically a really small town of about a little over 1,800 people, maybe 2,000 back then. And it was made up of blue-collar families that either worked in steel mills or in the mines or in the foundries. It was just the 50s and the 60s. Those were really big days of innocence. And Apollo abuts other towns and across the river from other towns in very close proximity. And so they're one of the hubs within the Kiske Valley. And the Kiske Valley is comprised of 13 communities. And you grew up here. You knew everybody in those 13 towns around.
When did you become aware of NUMEC, which stands for Nuclear Materials and Equipment Corporation? And how close to their facility did you live?
I grew up directly across the street from the plant, unknowingly across the street from a nuclear plant, and because it was an abandoned steel mill. And back in the day when I was, you know, coming up as a child, NUMEC got in there in 1957. And all we heard that it was an industry that was making fuel for Navy ships. The word nuclear, radiation, or atomic never came into, you know, the purview. But when I really first became aware of it was in December of 1988, when I came back home after retiring out from the United States government.
So the entire time you were growing up, you had no awareness that you had a nuclear facility next door. Did you have any sense of what they were doing with their waste material, or you just kind of played innocently throughout the area?
The kids would do what kids would do. I left the area at the age of 17, and I came back after I graduated from high school, and I came back intermittently. I went into the Navy, and I served for over 10 years, got out on a disability. And when I was in the Navy, I worked with Naval Investigative Service, which used to be called NIS. It's now fondly referred to as NCIS. And I got out and I came back to the area, but I wasn't in the valley. I went up to Indiana, Pennsylvania, and I used my GI Bill and I furthered my education. And then I got picked up by the Defense Department as a federal criminal investigator. And so I was assigned in different parts of the United States, the last place being Southern California.
What brought you back to that area? You said in 1988, and when did you start becoming aware that there was a problem with the NUMEC facility or what was left of it?
It was kind of twofold. My dad started getting ill, and then I wasn't feeling all that great, so I wanted to get closer to home. I had the time in service. I just retired out and came back home in December of 88.
What gave you the first awareness that there was a problem with NUMEC?
My dad. It was maybe just a couple days after I got home in December of 88. And he said, Patty, he said, you retired out from the government. He says, you do investigations. Could you find out for me and for some of the other people in the town what's going on over at the plant? I said, what do you mean what's going on over at the plant? And he said, well, that's a nuclear plant. And that was the first time I ever heard the word nuclear referred to that site. I said, really? And he said, yes. He said, and the company isn't telling us anything. And I says, well, Dad, a company's not going to tell you anything. They're going to protect their own liability. And he said, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission isn't telling us anything either. And again, I was so naive coming out of the government thinking that that was just a communication breakdown. He said, that place had a lot of stacks. And some people were saying that maybe it came one off site. My dad retired out from the steel mill directly across the street, less than 100 feet is where I grew up and where the deli that was attached to the house was located. And so a lot of those workers would go into the deli with their work clothes on. And my dad wanted to know, and he had every right to know, and so did everybody else in the town.
In other words, if there was any residue perhaps on their clothing that they may have been depositing in the store or in your local area?
No, because of the stacks, 124 stacks. When I started getting the documents, I was jaw-dropped at the amount of stacks that that plant had.
Let's roll this back to how you began your investigation of the site now that it's 1988 and your dad has made you aware that there may be some problems there.
After my dad made me promise to look into this, I found out that the plant was undergoing a decommissioning and that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission had put documents, considered it a public document room, in the town library. So I would go up there, and these documents were on microfiche, and they had one of these old dinosaur viewers that you would just have to sit there hours on end to look over them. Fortunately, this viewer had a printer on it as well. And so I was able to acquire some documents, and those documents really tweaked my interest because there was one, the very first document I ever read was a 1957 document, and it was pre-startup report that the company had an outside contractor to do. And this contractor went out and around the town and took sampling so that they would have a baseline of what the radiation levels were prior to this plant starting up. And on page four, there was just a two-sentence paragraph. And the contractors were telling the company and highly recommended that the plant carry on with regular testing in the unrestricted areas for the future potential of any changes in state and federal laws and regulations and for the potential of litigation. That was a very big flag to me.
It sounds like they were anticipating that there would be radiation or other forms of toxicity released and that there would be lawsuits down the road. Is that what you got from this two-sentence paragraph?
Absolutely. That they were dealing with something that would cause them a problem, and more than that, that would cause a problem for the people in the community.
Having gained this information, how did you proceed? What actions did you take, and how did you begin to build this case?
Well, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was having in Apollo what they called exit meetings, and the company would be there. A couple times I wanted to ask the company managers some questions, but the Nuclear Regulatory Commission would not allow the company to answer questions, and I thought this very odd. It really appeared that they were shielding. They were the buffer. It didn't sit well. And then I noticed that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, when anybody in the community would ask about different levels of radiation that they would find or what type of testing they were doing inside of the plant, they would come back and they would mix their formulas. They would mix rotogens with Becquerels, with picocuries per gram. They would mix this all up. And the people of this area are working class. And so the level of communication that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was bringing forth to the general public was intimidating them. They didn't know what they were speaking about. And the NRC did that on purpose.
Yes, they do. The entire industry does, because if we can't understand the quantities they are talking about and how they are measuring them, it makes us feel inadequate to the task, and we tend to back off, and they've achieved what they want to achieve, which is totally obfuscating the information that we so dearly need to know. When you saw that there was this kind of a blockade to the information, with you being a trained researcher, investigator, what did you do to start tracking down the truth?
Well, I started getting more documents. My brother-in-law worked at that plant, and those guys were threatened with prison if they would have said anything about anything regarding what they did at that facility. And so he wouldn't talk to me. The mindset that the company was putting out to their workers was that any questions, the public could jeopardize their jobs. The workers had no idea that they were going to be without jobs. The company blew smoke up their backside saying that they were just doing a cleanup. They were decommissioning and stopping one operation, going to do another operation, you know, to come in. They were totally blind with this. Part of the decommissioning, there was a contractor that was located in town, and Pauline was a whistleblower. She had her own company called ECO, the Environmental Compliance Organization. And I used to pick Pauline's brain, but she wasn't the only one. Over the course of years, I have had the benefit of fantastic people like the late Dr. Alice Stort, the late Dr. John Goffman, the late Dr. Mancuso, who lived right up in Pittsburgh, Dr. Arjun Makhijani, who was one of our experts in the first federal civil action that I spearheaded.
You are gathering this information together. Once you got the documents and you started being aware that there was a problem here, what were some of the early actions that you took to start building a case or at least investigating further?
Some of the people were coming to me because they knew I was retired out from the government, and I would go to these meetings. But then I had some people coming to me and telling me that their dog, 5 years old, dying of cancer. And I noticed one day just driving around, there were two, you know, in a small town, there were two people walking their dogs at different locations in the town, and they both had visible tumors all over these dogs. And so I went around to some of the vets and just asked them if they had noticed any incidents or increases in cancers in the dogs and the cats and any other animals. And they said it was very striking increase in cancers in these animals. From there, I went to the funeral homes and I asked the funeral home directors about how many cancers they were seeing. Was there a significant amount of cancers? And they concurred there was a significant amount of cancers and cancers in children. And that made me take a foot. I went around door to door. And in one community, Oklahoma, there was a street, and that's up over the hill across the river, is 200 feet from Apollo, and that's up on the hill. There was a street that had 16 homes. There were 8 homes in a row that all the women had breast cancer.
Wow.
Yeah, that was very striking to me. It was worse. And that was just the Apollo area. I went down to the Parks Township area where they had the plutonium facility. Here's this plutonium facility, and it abutted a dairy farm. I constantly was thinking, does this milk do a body good? I remember being able to see years ago the dairy cattle sitting out there because I would ride with my dad out of Apollo into Leechburg where he worked at. And I just remember those dairy cattle and not paying attention to what the other buildings were there. You just didn't know. And nobody suspected because there wasn't a fence around that facility. There weren't placards. There were no cautionary signs, nothing that nobody would ever talk about, any warning.
Once you were collecting this information, what actions did you start taking on it?
I kept asking to have some off-site testing.
Who were you asking?
I asked the Nuclear Regulatory Commission at some of the exit meetings if they could please do some off-site testing to allay any fears, concerns, or questions that the general public would have concerning any possible emissions from that plant that may have escaped that plant. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, joined with the manager of the company, continuously stated that everything was perfectly safe and nothing went over the fence.
Right.
And it was at that meeting that a woman by the name of Fran Munko stood up, just a housewife, Fran, stood up and asked the NRC manager at the time, a gentleman by the name of Jerome Roth, didn't you do some testing off-site? We saw you down at the riverbank. Could you tell us, did you find any contamination? And he is doing the NRC dance move of mixing all the different formulas together and just giving her a bunch of over highly technical gobbledygook. Mm-hmm. And so I saw Fran just kind of wilt down in her seat. But then she got back up again and she said, excuse me, I didn't understand what you said. Could you just answer the question? Yes or no? Did you find any contamination offsite? And then my trigger got pulled because that NRC official told her to sit down and shut up. That she had already had her question. That was all she wrote for me.
What did you do at that point?
Any civil decorum that I had, it left the door. It exited. And my voice can bellow quite a bit.
I have no doubt.
And from the back of the hall, I said, you cannot talk to these people this way. You're a public servant. These people have questions, and you're required to give them the answers. And, they basically closed a meeting up at that particular point, and I left out of there. I was good and pissed.
What did you do with that energy?
What I started doing after that was to raise the public awareness. I knew that the company had the workers hogtied and scared about ever talking, and that the public was so trusting of our government. And so I was going out, was wearing sandwich board signs on my torso and carrying one in each hand saying, honk if you want to be safe. And DEP, protect the people, not the industry. And I was asking for an investigation. It meant raising awareness, and it meant asking as an investigator what we know of is called the peak attention questions. Asking the questions, and for the most part with the documents that I would have, I already had the answers. I wanted to hear what they said in public.
And what were they saying in public?
They were evasive. They wouldn't answer. They would continue on with the spiel that everything is perfectly safe. Everything is perfectly safe. Then I went to a council meeting in Apollo and tried to get the fathers of the town to try to mandate or request the state to do off-site testing. Now, at this time, I was already diagnosed with one of my brain tumors. And there were a lot of incidents of brain tumors in that small town. And so I asked him, I said, look, we are a government that is based on a check and balance system. I understand and sympathize with the company's right to withhold any information. However, a lot of people in this town, including myself, is somewhat skeptical of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So could we then ask as a body, a governing body, for the EPA to come in and do some tests as a check and balance system? The manager of that plant was there. His name was Joe Sapega. He came to me and he said, Miss Amino, if you would like to pay for all the cleanup costs and the delays that would occur therefrom, then go ahead. He attempted to intimidate me. Well, the council took a break for an executive session on this issue, and Joe Sapega called me out into the hallway, and he said, look, we haven't been formally introduced. I think I came off on some bad footing. My name is Joe Sapega, and I'm the manager of the plant. And I said, yes, I know. He said, we did a lot of business at your mom and dad's deli over there. I said, well, they appreciate it, and you got your money's worth. You didn't bring me out here to talk about my mom and dad's deli. What is it that you wish to speak about? And then he went on to tell me that what I was doing was not healthy for me. And I looked at him. I said, what the hell did you just tell me? He said, what you're doing is not healthy for you. And then the council came out of the office, and then Mr. Sapega turned and said, well, the document you want, it should be up in the public document room. And that was more fuel on my fire. I don't get intimidated. It just makes me angry.
And we're up to what year here?
1992.
So we're in 1992, and you've come as far as, it sounds like, being threatened by the
yes.
manager of NUMEC.
I don't take kind to threats. And so I started looking into Mr. Joe Sapega. And then under Title 10 of the Code of Federal Regulations, it's quite distinct of what the minimum requirements are in order to be a nuclear plant manager, i.e. for the Apollo plant, which was a uranium hexafluoride facility, there was a minimum requirement of a Bachelor of Science degree in the nuclear or technical field and 10 years minimum of experience in the same. For the plutonium facility, it was the same in education, but 15 years experience in the nuclear or technical field. Now understand, they only had one manager for both facilities. When I looked him up, he only had a Bachelor of Arts degree, and his only prior experience was that of being co-owner with his brother in a hardware store that went belly up in Monroeville, Pennsylvania. That was all she wrote. Then I started really firing up the Nuclear Regulatory Commission at that point. He didn't get fired. Here's what the NRC did. I had to embarrass the NRC in front of television cameras to do something, and what they did, they issued a notice of violation, but then they changed his title and still kept him there and credited him with 7 years' experience.
Not surprising. So you've got an area where there is a peak of cancer showing up in children, breast cancer in women, tumors in dogs, additional cancers showing up through the mortuaries and the people who have died. You've got all of this evidence that you are accumulating. Give us a sense of how the years went by while you were working at it, because we're only up to 1992 at this point.
Well, let me take you then to 1993. I had been working with Congressman John P. Murtha, and I got tired, and I asked him, because when you go to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and ask a question, they would pawn it off and say, that's not our jurisdiction, that's the State Department of Environmental Protection's jurisdiction. Go to the state, they would come back with us, that's not our jurisdiction, that's the EPA's. I'm not going to chase my tail. So I went to Congressman Murtha and I said, we need a meeting to have a representative from all these agencies here so they can't continuously pass the buck. And that's exactly what happened. 6 months down the road, Congressman Murtha got us that meeting. And that meeting was advertised in the paper for 3 days to have time limitations. Now, under Robert's Rules of Order, that's about 3 to 5 minutes. You give me 3 to 5 minutes, I'm going to do some damage. But when we got into the meeting, you signed, as always, signed in. Then they asked us to take a number. And I said, what are you doing here? You give a raffle away at an environmental meeting? And they said, no. When your number's called, you get one question and one question only. I was off the hook. That was it. They did an unannounced, unadvertised changeup that was completely out of line. And then I noticed that there was police in the meeting. Never before they had police at the meeting. An hour and a half before that meeting, I had a phone call from the company's Babcock & Wilcox's attorney. He said, I understand you have some documents. And I said, I do. He said, would you be interested in meeting with me so we can go over those documents and so we can negotiate through them? He said the key word, negotiate. And so I told him, I said, I'd love to meet with you and discuss documents. However, I have a meeting I have to go to. He said, yes, yes, I know, I know. I said, but if you really want to know about these documents, he says, yes, I do, I do. I said, I suggest you pick the paper up tomorrow morning. Thank you very much. Click. An hour and a half later, I get to the meeting. The police is there. They changed it up. I ended up getting arrested for asking too many questions at a public meeting. 9 months later, I was acquitted, and then I turned around and sued the town because they ended up getting the town to facilitate it. The company did, and so did the NRC. And so I knew that it was just a matter of time because a couple months before that, my brake lines had been cut, all four of them.
On your car?
On my car. I could never say with definite who did it, but I had never had any problems before. In November of 1993, I spoke to Bill Silkwood, as in Karen Silkwood's father, because I knew at that particular point, after that arrest, they were going to keep coming after me. They had the police following me and stopping me, checking my registration, checking my insurance and everything. You know, I had a hard way to go because the community was behind the government at the time. So I called Bill Silkwood. I told him what my plight was. He said, you need to talk to an attorney. I says, well, could you tell me who it was that was representing Karen that she was due to meet? And he said, that's Steve Walker. He had changed his name because he didn't want the notoriety in the movie. He gave me Steve's number. I called Steve up. He was familiar with NUMMEC. He said, do you have any documents? I said, yeah, how many do you want? He said, how many do you have? I said, thousands at this point. And he says, well, just give me some of the most demonstrative evidence. I said, okay. I said, do you want any videotape? He said, he started laughing. He said, you got videotaped too? I said, yeah, I videotaped. He said, send it on. I sent it overnight express. He was in my living room 3 days later. On June the 6th, 1994, that first federal civil action was filed.
So you filed your first federal action against Babcock & Wilcox and Atlantic Richfield Corporation in 1994. How far did that get, and what did you have to do to follow up on it?
Well, that case took 14 years. However, Fred Barron, who was the lead attorney, when it came to trial in 1998, of 200 people who were on, there was 8 people who were the first test plaintiffs. That the case, when it went to trial, of the first 8 test plaintiffs, the jury awarded those people $37.6 million. And the most important thing out of a federal civil action is discovery, because there came the mother load of documents right there that had never seen the light of day before. They were released to my attorney, and my attorney gave them all to me as well.
And this is the same attorney as was Karen Silkwood's attorney?
He was one of Karen Silkwood's attorneys, yes.
Incredible. So with this first finding, was there any kind of resolution for the case, or did this just open up additional channels?
That case was finally settled in two parts. 2007, Atlantic Richfield bailed on Babcock and Wilcox, and they settled. And Babcock and Wilcox finally settled in 2009. The overall settlements were approximately $92 million.
Who was it who received that $92 million?
People in the community who had either buried their children, buried their husbands or wives, or who had cancers that were survivors. These were not workers.
What has since happened to take care of the workers?
All the documents that I was finding regarding the workers at the document room that the NRC had set up, I was completely shocked with how they just openly, they didn't redact any of the information on the workers. I mean, their dates of birth, their social security numbers, everything was just out there. I was getting these documents and putting them aside because I knew the suffering. I had actually seen and knew of several cases where the company had let some of the workers go that were getting sick, and they didn't have any insurance, nothing. They ended up losing their homes. It was just a damn shame what was happening here.
What are the various settlements that have taken place? Because I know that as of a few weeks ago, there was an ultimate finding about the cleanup taking place. Talk us through where the different cases were and what was achieved by each one of them.
On the civil end, of course, there was the first federal civil action that I spearheaded, 14 years, $92 million to 200 plaintiffs. In 2010, I spearheaded a second federal civil action suit. That's an appeal right now, so that's still not settled. On the regulatory end, I had a hearing with the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board panel. It was a paper hearing on the Parks Township nuclear site because the waste dump came under their operations license at that time, and they were planning on splitting the license. And I knew if they split the license, they were going to leave us in perpetuity with the waste, and that's exactly what they had tried to do. That I didn't win, but I still was able to get some of the NRC and the officials at B&W and ARCO on the record with affidavits that later came back in federal civil actions to bite them. At the same time, our sewage authority was contaminated. They had a lagoon over there, and it was contaminated with plutonium, daughter product americium-241. But the NRC kept saying that it was just minute amounts, and I kept telling them to go deeper. They didn't want to go deeper. I would just push it. And so the NRC's resolve for this, they had a unannounced meeting at an archery place outside of the area, and I found out about it. They were actually going to give a sewage authority a nuclear license to just leave it there.
In other words, name it a nuclear waste site, and that would give it permission, and it wouldn't have to be cleaned up?
No, they would just give a nuclear license for it to be there, period. So when I found out about this meeting, I got there, and they had called it a meeting, but then at the meeting, they tried to do a disco move of going straight into a hearing that would have been unannounced. And I shut it down. I came close to kicking tables over that night. And then they stopped. And then I went to the DEP secretary, who was Katie McGinty. She was in Clinton's White House. She headed up CEQ one time. The Council on Environmental Quality, that office is in the White House. I met with Secretary McGinty in 2007. Pennsylvania had a specific law. It was Act 107 and specifically Section 104 that stated any special nuclear material in any amounts, any quantities must go to a licensed facility. So Secretary McGinty reversed the decision that DEP had been taking, which was a wrong-headed decision for years. The wrong-headed decision was to be in compliance with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, either giving them a nuclear license or having it merely sent to municipal landfills where we take our household trash to so somebody else could get it. Kicking it down the road, anything for the company not to have to pay what they should be paying for.
Okay, so you had the meeting with her and she reversed the decision. what was the ruling or what was the decision that came out?
That it had to be cleaned up. And it got cleaned up. That was actually a really good success.
Let's get clear on something. How many settlements have there been in this case? How many major rulings have there had to be to get to the point where now the Army Corps of Engineers is going to do the cleanup in Park Township?
Okay, well, the Army Corps of Engineers in Parks Township is one thing. One has to understand that NUMEC was a multi-headed, multi-faceted beast here. NUMEC, Atlantic Richfield Corporation, Babcock and Wilcox. You had the Apollo site. That was a separate thing. But from the Apollo site, then you had the contamination of the river and whatever went into the sewage authority. And, of course, the sewage authority was another thing because that was accumulation of both the Apollo and the park site. Now, the Apollo decommissioning, that got done. Then you had the plutonium facility. Okay, and the operations was one thing, and then you had the burials, to what I've been dealing with the Corps of Engineers, and then you had the federal civil actions and the workers. So I was juggling and doing all these things at one time.
And who did you have as support on this? Were you part of an organization? Was this a crew of people, a committee of people?
No, I did this myself, and thank God I was able to get probably the best environmental attorney in the country, the attorneys, Steve Walker, the late Fred Barron, and his team, oh my goodness, Kay Reeves, Alicia Butler, Michael Kasky, who's down in Texas.
So with all of these settlements, as of a few weeks ago, the ruling came out that the cleanup is going to take place through the Army Corps of Engineers. Is that the FUSRAP program?
It is.
So FUSRAP is going to be doing the cleanup of Parks Township.
That's correct.
What is still on the horizon for this site? Or is it finally the opportunity for you to lay the cudgel down?
Now, I wish I could lay it down. But you see, the SLDA, the waste dump, was separated from the original license of the operations site. And the waste dump area that is fenced in now is about 44.5 acres. However, the original deeded licensed property at the time the operations were intact and the burials took place was 193 acres. And I can tell you they buried on just about every inch of that property. I think it's going to come in two parts. The Corps of Engineers will work on the SLDA. And I am looking to get the EPA with the areas outside of the SLDA. I do not want to muddy the waters with what I had to fight for and what's been fought for with respect to the SLDA.
Just clarify for me, SLDA.
The shallow land disposal area, and that's the $350 million plus cleanup of the 44.5 acres.
That's what's going to be cleaned up under FUSRAP.
That's correct.
Where are you now in terms of your health?
Well, every day above ground's a good day. I'm still vertical sucking air on my end, so I guess I'm okay. I still have another brain tumor. You know, I'm to the point now, because I've been through so much. I mean, I've had my head opened up twice for one brain tumor. I still have another brain tumor. I've had uterine cancer. Those are the things I attribute to being exposed by the industry. That's a side of physical problems I've dealt with when I was in the Navy. I'm basically with the mindset now that I don't even want to go to a doctor. I'm just ready to take whatever comes. But I don't want to hear any bad news because I have enough to fight right now. Here's the one thing I've always believed. The truth may sometimes stand alone, but it always stands and people will get behind it when they know it.
I understand that you have been in contact through the years with the moms from the Westlake area in North St. Louis and been certainly a source of information and advice to them.
They are wonderful down there. And, you know, I think it's our duty as activists for whatever knowledge we have, because knowledge is power. I haven't been able to go down there, and I really hope in the spring to get down to Bridgeton, Westlake area, to meet some of these fantastic people. And meeting over Facebook and just feeling, I can feel their yearn, their craving for some justice, for somebody to do something down there. They know they're in a cesspool.
I know that in the interviews and the other talking that I've done with Karen Nickel and with Dawn Chapman from the Westlake Moms, that you have been a resource to them and someone who has been able to support them, not only with information, but with the kind of emotional support that one needs in dealing with nuclear.
You know, it's a lot that they're taking on. There's a lot of people that are out, and that's fantastic. Everybody should be out. I'm appalled at the local governments, right on up to the governor's office. I'm appalled at the way that the people have just been dismissed with their concerns. Whatever I can do, whatever resources I have, whether it's support, whether it's documents, whatever it is, I'm going to try to help them, because those are my brothers and sisters, not only there, but Irwin, Tennessee, out in California, up in Canada, all over the place. We have a lot of bridge making that we've done as activists across this country.
Patty, we wish you every health, every blessing, every support possible. And truly, you are an example of what a single, motivated, focused individual can do in battling nuclear. When we can come together with you and with people like you all over, we can succeed. It takes time, it takes energy, it takes focus, it takes stamina, but we can do this. And you are a living example of that.
Thank you, Libby. And I'll tell you what you do is an enormous resource for people in getting that information disseminated. And I thank you very, very much.
Patty Amino, who passed away on May 10, 2024. She was 72 years old. We will have links up to other interviews and her obituary on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode number 674. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, May 21st, 2024. Hey, too much is going on. You cannot afford to miss a single episode of Nuclear Hot Seat. So the best way to get it? Sign up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, in the big yellow box, put in your first name and email address, and by email every week, you'll get one, count it, one email with a link to the show and a brief description of the content. You can also sign up for it on any of the podcast platforms. Now, if you've got a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send it via email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And listen up. Remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, especially given the fact that our anniversary is coming up, we really need your help. Anything at all, we will appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2024, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as you cite the program, the website, names of guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat reminding you, nuclear kills two ways, fast by blast, slow by glow, meaning radiation, radioactivity. Either way, nuclear kills, unless we can figure out a way to get rid of it first. There you have it. You have just had your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.